This week, we read harsh words from Manly P. Hall as he exposes fake occultists, those who would be masters if not for their lack of true knowledge or work ethic. Don't miss what is perhaps some of the most critical things Manly P. Hall ever wrote. We'll dive into a segment that defines the Rosicrucians from the early 19th century, elite Masons who were on a quest. Steve Harrison stops by to remind us of the other 66% of what makes up this great fraternity. It seems that we're all missing it. Finally, we'll wrap it up with a piece on the spiritualist ideas of the Great Brotherhood of Man, a praise for the working man occultist, and more. Don't miss it.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 440. As you heard in the top of the show, we've got a great show for you this week. Three pieces of education plus. The illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison is stopping by for another amazing and all-new segment of the Masonic Minute. Now, before we jump right in, I do want to say if you are out there on the interwebs and you consume this podcast via YouTube, make sure you're subscribing, liking the videos. But most importantly, understand that the videos that illustrious Brother Harrison puts together for our Masonic Minute are all hosted there also. So it's a great way to put together some great content, put together playlists, and put those on at your lodge meetings, or just put together a cool playlist, and in these times where we're not allowed to gather, go ahead and share them with your brothers. In addition, just under the news, I feel it's appropriate to go ahead and talk about a couple things. Number one, if you're on Facebook, check out the Refracted Light Facebook group. If you're on Facebook, check it out. If you're not on Facebook, create a burner account and just get in there and check it out, because there are dudes who are giving amazing Masonic presentations every single week, and it's just a really fantastic resource, not to mention the fact that there are other podcasts that have just started, including Meet, Act, and Part, a podcast done by Gregory Knott, Bill Hosler, Todd Creason, and Darren Lehners. They've done some really great work on their podcast, including the latest episode, which has illustrious Brother Harrison on there as a guest. Another podcast that I just learned about at the time of recording this, actually, is the Rocky Mountain Mason has a podcast. I guess they just unveiled it, and I just saw a link for it recently on my Facebook feed. So this is super exciting, especially coming from one of the most exemplary Masonic magazines in print today. Really, in my mind, there are only a few that are just amazing, Rocky Mountain Mason being one of them. And if I may, one of the perks to be a executive pass holder for Chicago Masonicon is that you will get a one-year subscription to Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. So that's $33 value right there. It's a really great magazine. I was pleased to pick it up. I just got my issue in the mail, actually, and they printed one of my articles that I wrote about the Rite of Memphis. And it's a longer piece. I hope you guys will enjoy it. It's kind of written in a somewhat entertaining way. But the real gem in this particular issue, in my opinion, I mean, Brother Kevin Townley is in this issue as well, but one of my favorite articles in this particular issue is by Brother Patrick Day. Brother Patrick has you may remember Patrick was on our show a few months back, and he did a piece for this particular magazine in this issue called The Problem with Esoteric Masonry, in which he really dissects many of the wild reasons why esoteric Masons fail at bringing education to those who might not be into the esoteric, bringing it into their scope of understanding. And on the flip side of the coin, he talks about those non-esoteric Masons and how they need to learn some tolerance and be okay with learning something. So a really great piece that he put together here in Rocky Mountain Mason is issue number 22. So I would encourage you to check that out. You can go to RockyMountainMason.com, get your subscription. $33. It's a great, great piece. As I understand it, they are going to be putting out a strictly esoteric magazine in addition, at some point in the future. I think they're gaining some traction there, seeing who's interested in it. But if you follow them on Facebook, then you no doubt have seen that announcement as well. Speaking of magazines, another wonderful magazine. I got to give a huge shout out to the Southern California Research Lodges magazine. They produce, which is called Fraternal Review, a wonderful magazine. Again, amazing content. Usually it's 16 pages. They publish 10 months a year, so each issue is only 16 pages. This issue, they had some wonderful content, so it went to 20 pages. Super cool issue. It's called Fight Club and Freemasonry. You might be thinking, what in the world does Fight Club have to do with Freemasonry? But I think I can tell you that it has everything to do with Freemasonry, just in the universal scope and the duality of man. It's a really interesting concept, and wonderful, wonderful authors in there as well. So check them out. You can find them at theresearchlodge.com. As we have established, this is a time in world history where everything is different. Everything has changed, and it is so unprecedented in terms of the way we have to deal with things, because there have been pandemics before, but not in the way that we have them today. You know, in 1918, you couldn't telework, you couldn't work from home, not like we do today. So with all the stuff that's going on, and I understand so many people out there who are having to find new jobs, who have lost their jobs, and all of this thing. So we're foregoing any and all advertisements for the show, and we're just going to do the education with the one caveat, and I will say many thanks. I want to thank our producers, our fellows, and our contributors, those people who make this show happen through thick and thin, and who make this show available for everyone, all episodes forever, especially in times like this when not everybody can afford to assist us with those things. So a special thank you for our producers, fellows, and contributors, whether you're on Patreon or PayPal. You guys are amazing in keeping this thing going in this time of need. And one last item before I jump into the education this week is the fact that I saw a wonderful post on Facebook from the Grand Lodge of Ohio. I'm an honorary member in Ohio, and so I follow this feed. One of my good friends and brothers, Michael Hambricht of the Masonic Roundtable, actually clued me in on this post, and basically there has been some really wonderful things that the Brothers of Ohio have been doing, including prescription drop-offs and grocery drop-off for, you know, people who can't get out or shouldn't be getting out. And I thought, wow, this is how Freemasonry is relevant. You know, not just toasting on the internet, not doing these things that actually have no inherent value. These have real value. These are guys who are stepping it up. And I just thought how amazing and wonderful it was. So just want to say thank you so much to those Ohio brothers who are doing that. And to any brother all over the world, wherever you may be, thanks for what you're doing, whoever it is, and whatever they need in these uncertain times. This week's education comes from a few different sources. Now, the sources largely come from a mega repository that is funded exclusively by a few people, some academics. It's called the International Association for the Preservation of Spiritualist and Occult Periodicals. Now, that sounds like a lot, but if you go to IAPSOP.com, check them out. You can search all these publications there, and they have most of the issues that you can grab and search and download PDFs, all of these kind of things. So check them out when you can. Think about financially supporting them if you can. This is a monumental endeavor. They have to pay the British Library thousands of dollars every year to have access to some of the stuff that they put up on the website for everybody to dive into. So just think about that. The first one that I want to read you comes from The All-Seeing Eye. I read you an article last week from The All-Seeing Eye. It's All-Seeing Eye, The Modern Problems in the Light of Ancient Wisdom, a monthly magazine written, edited, and compiled, Manly P. Hall, September 1923. A special note that this magazine is not sold. As I was browsing through this particular issue for a relevant article, I found one such article that really intrigued me. There were actually two from this issue. One was called Prometheus, the Eternal Sufferer, and the other was called Impractical Occultists. So just a little bit of history before we dive into this is that there are several texts out there that are called Practical Occultism, the Practical Occult. Practical Occultism is a series of lessons within Builders of the Adytum. It is also a book that is out in the theosophical circles that you can pick up at any one of the Quest bookstores. But again, this one is from this particular issue, but again, this one is from September 1923, and it's called Impractical Occultists. The greatest stumbling block that confronts students of the wisdom teachings seems to be the problem of proper application. A large number of so-called students are merely theorists living in a world of their own creation, separated by transcendental ideas from all of the practical problems of life. They live, move, and have their being within a crystalline shell of their own making, which they seem unable to break through to contact the daily problems of life. The great cry is not for abstract ideas, but for practical remedies to be applied to the world in harmonies and international diseases, which we now know as plagues, wars, and economic disturbances. Occultists and mystics who are not able to apply their philosophies to the great bread-and-butter necessities of life have failed entirely to grasp the real truths of universal knowledge. Why do we find so many students who have lost contact with their brother man? They live alone on the tops of mountains, gazing down with supercilious mien upon the tiny ants and grubs which appear mere grains of nothingness from their elevated but not superior position. Why does the student have the feeling that everyone is beneath him in ethics and ideals? And why, oh why, is he too good to work? This list of questions might be continued indefinitely as one unexplainable why after another passes in endless procession, few of them complementary to the traits and qualities exhibited by so-called students of the wisdom teachings. There is no denying the fact that mystics are unusual people, but the strangest of all are the pseudo-mystics, who are hanging twixt heaven and hell in wondrous parachute of self-created concepts. Their eyes are upon the stars, with which they seek union, and thoughtlessly and heedlessly, they push less fortunate brothers to one side, trampling on the rights of others, shirking with studious care their own responsibilities. They seem to feel, for some unknown reason, that the world should honor, adore, and bask in the presence of all who claim to be seekers of the light, and that all should hasten to cooperate in perpetuating the indolence of the average truth seeker. The quote-unquote mystic feels and expresses in his life the idea that the world owes him a living, that it should honor, respect, and support him, and rush to his beck and call, because his mind is filled with the contemplation of the absolute. Being engaged in such weighty and brain-racking thoughts, and his inspiration should not be disturbed by the rent man, the grocer, or the cries of an atrophying stomach, but that someone gathered from the worlds of the unenlightened should do these things for him, and so leave the master dreamer undisturbed in his celestial nightmares. Let us study these questions, the eternal wise, and arrange them with the analytical mind of a logical thinker free from much spirituality and theoretical concept, and find the underlying innate reason concealed behind these eccentricities of the exponents of divine wisdom. An old saying is that the devil is proficient in quoting scripture, and always does it to purpose. And just so the lowest qualities in human nature eternally seek vindication beneath a mock robe of the highest and most beautiful. When we ask the question, why does not an occultist work? He excuses himself by saying he is serving the Lord. Is concentrating upon world salvation or unfolding his consciousness through hours of meditation and other strange exercises which he is forced to perform 24 hours a day that he may prevent an earthquake, a tidal wave, or a revolution. Another will tell you that he cannot find anything to do that is congenial with his spiritual views. Another is incapacitated by the delicate constitution, etc. This is what they tell us. But when we analyze the problem, we find the real reason for the inertia among the quote-unquote divine is unadulterated laziness, which inherent desire to escape labor seeks to cloak itself beneath spirituality. It is in this innate quality of the lower bodies to escape the battle of the world which is the basis of recluses, hermits, and cranks. First, it is a habit, then an eccentricity, later, a fanaticism, then an obsession, and finally, a murderer. A man humors these lazy little principles within himself until they become giants and he is murdered by his own creations. A large percentage of so-called students of the mystic philosophy make no practical effort to be useful in the world affairs, or to meet the battles of life, and the real reason for this is they are lazy, but have found a pleasant, intellectual, highly respectable channel of human expression in which they can make themselves believe that inertia is a virtue, and whatever doctrine teaches that laziness is a desirable condition will be attended by an overflowing membership. No one likes to work without special training. No matter how you enjoy a certain thing, if you have to do it continually, it becomes monotonous. The human soul cries for freedom from routine, and so our mystics assume various gymnastic poses. To quote authorities on the subject, they aspire to soar as eagles from crag to crag. So we see some generously proportioned disciple of things spiritual trying to balance gracefully upon one toe on a pinnacle of an ethereal cloud waves, or to flutter aesthetically from moonbeam to moonbeam, crying in ecstasy as the gentle zephyrs flush his cheeks, free as a bird. Upon this basis of spiritual aspiration, thousands of people who could make respectable grocers, clerks, window washers, firemen, and floor walkers are now lounging around listening to delirio-scientific outbursts and waiting impatiently for their avoir dupuis to become transmuted into spiritual ethers that they may slip through the window, wafted on the gentle breath of Eros. So, we may say, by way of a brief condensation, that our so-called spiritual works are producing a series of lazy failures who would not do an honest day's work for the ransom of Croesus. And to top irony with calumny, they not only continue systematically to do nothing, but they expect to be respected and praised for it, and pointed out as a glorious spiritual success as they toll around, waiting like Wilkins Micawber, for something to turn up. Quote-unquote occultists with temperament are not uncommon. Some simply can't stand a breath of air. Others are overwhelmed with nausea when they contact an ordinary human being. Some are shrouded in repugnance when it becomes necessary to converse with a menial person. While our scintillating lights of brotherhood edge gently away from such individuals as bricklayers, butchers, and ministers, most of our quote-unquote mystics have super nerves, and a large percentage of them have that peculiar disease which turns the backbone into a wishbone, said wishbone being very wobbly and lacking sufficient strength to permit the individual leaning himself against it. This makes it necessary for him to find someone else to lean on, to tell his troubles to, and blame for all his failures. A person who is not busily engaged in something is a danger to the community, regardless of his religion. Wars, crimes, pestilences, gossip, and parlor parasites are the outgrowths and products of the germ of laziness. And never mind how quote-unquote spiritual a person may be, if he is not really busy at some material, tangible, and result-producing thing, he is a danger not only to himself, but to others who might be infected by the bacilli he is propagating. The sooner occultists get the idea out of their system that it is degenerating to be one with the world, the sooner they will really become spiritual. Taking it as a general entire, at the present time, the mystics, new thoughtists, and so-called spiritual students are the most unreliable series of people alive. Their word is not worth shucks. Their powers of concentration are nil. They do not know one end of an umbrella from another. and are as lazy as all outdoors. When put to work to earn their daily bread like the rest of the suffering humanity, all they do is stand around and try to impress others with the necessity of realizing that an electron is smaller than a molecule, or that God is all there is. This class entirely overlooks the fact that if God is all there is, that it is unnecessary for one part of Him to tell the other part about it. If each will mind his own business, God will take care of the entire. There is no class more dangerous than the soul savers who, having just found a little light, becomes overly enthusiastic about it. They rouse you out of bed in the wee small hours, serenade under your window, or make you stand out in the backyard while muffins are burning, informing you that your present concepts are sure to result in a permanent Turkish bath for you after demise. It is the height of sarcasm to have some worm-eaten individual whose hand clasp reminds you that your fingers have closed over a clam whose limpid personality has neither backbone, strength, activity, nor even the human attributes of cheerfulness, come up to you with tears in his eyes and try to save your soul, or illuminate your consciousness in ways of success. At the same time, borrow 298 until next week. Now comes a still more important problem. Oh, why are all occultists broke? There is more pecuniary embarrassment among our modern spiritual demonstrators than in the immigrant class. Every one of them are strictly up against it. And when asked why, they will answer that the world has not treated them right and that their high spiritual motives make it impossible for them to join the ranks of money grabbers and punctilious cash profiteers who make up the business systems. The quote-unquote mystic will tell you that his tender consciousness revolts against commercialism. Therefore, he is not well fixed because he cannot go back to that money-mad world he left behind. However, his conscience never seems to revolt against letting somebody else go out and earn it for him. And we find from proofs that when our quote-unquote mystic does get any money, he is just as commercial as the person he points out as a horrible example. Now, why in plain English is he broke? The answer is, he lacks concentration of purpose, system, regularity, efficiency, and the worst of all, he cannot take orders. The average occultist will condescend to be the leader of almost anything, but to be an office boy shocks his tender sentiments. He believes that his knowledge of rounds and periods should make him of inestimable value in a boiler factory and qualify him to be the president of a paperclip manufacturing company on general principles. The fact that he has a personal contact with God should highly recommend him in the world of affairs, when in reality it only places the taboo mark on him. For the businessman has found that dreamy mystics do not sell china well, nor peg good shoes. One of the main reasons why occultists do not succeed in business is the fact that the world is filled with a number of people, each one of them desiring to think as he pleases, wear what he pleases, eat what he pleases, and smoke stogies if he so desires. When he goes to buy a pair of shoes or have an inch sawed off his cork leg and the salesman tries to baptize him or initiate him into the value of hops tea, he does not usually return, but goes where they sell shoes instead of titillating advice. There is a very wide gap between heaven and earth, and the businessman who lives in heaven all the time will undoubtedly lose his customers. Heaven is a very abstract place. It does not satisfy an appetite nor vulcanize tires, and the individual who tries to live there all his life will undoubtedly reach his goal prematurely as a result of starvation. And the worst part is that these occultists will never reach heaven by the routes that they have assigned for themselves, but day by day in every way they are going further and further astray. Their theories will not bring down the price of milk in summer nor clean the mosquitoes out of the Jersey flats. They will not inaugurate an era of brotherhood, but if the modern religious mystic got hold of conditions, we would have a smotherhood rule instead. We have wars regularly, earthquakes per annum, pestilences, crime waves, etc., just as though occultists did not gather around their cold slaw like the farmers used to do down in Rumpus Ridge, where they dissected the next election over the checkerboard. And when all is taken and boiled down, in spite of much talk, there are very few occultists who have really done anything for themselves or anyone else which they couldn't have done as atheists just as well. All they have amassed in a series of intellectual concepts and theoretical speculations which have never been applied and would not work if they were. That rather hazy word, truth, covers a multitude of sins. The realization of God covers a lot more. The impersonal is a mystic tarpaulin, while divine love reaches entirely across the gamut between bootleg and blackmail. But all this does not produce honest politics, nor do the great international problems adjust themselves through our mystic luminaries. And if it was not for the work of a few who really do know and do apply, things would be in a very sorry plight indeed. There is but one answer to the question, and that is the practical living of a life of daily service and helpfulness in the community. When the student applies to living problems which surround him in the theoretical knowledge, which is useless until so applied, he will be an occultist, but not before. While the occultist evades the material world, he overlooks one of nature's most fundamental laws. Let the mystic remember that he was not ordained to be ornamental, but to be useful. He should also remember that hell, not heaven, is to be the field of his activities.
Because, from last reports, heaven is quite able to take care of itself. A mystic who believes that heaven is to be his resting place, and that he will be privileged to lounge forever on a bed of phoenix feathers, to gargle nectar and ambrosia through sunbeam straws, has a cruel awakening before him. He may also well get used to adversity right here, because in accepting the master's work, he has signified his willingness to give up the comforts and peace which mark material existence, and work in a way which may be given to him in the name of the great light which he is seeking to discover. The realization that the world's salvation depends on the willingness of mankind to learn lessons is of great importance, and students who go around fussing and stewing because of the adversity which surrounds them are not setting examples worthy of a moment's consideration. The world needs practical people. It needs better lawyers, better doctors, better ministers, government officials, and able citizens. Conscientious shopkeepers, mechanics, and artisans whose work is better and more perfect will thus help to glorify the entire. All constructive works are noble and worthy, and conscientious labor with the ability to master the unpleasantness of routine is necessary for advancement. The average occultist does not realize what an important place a handshake fills in character analysis. Have you ever shaken hands with a mystic? Try it sometime. You will find that his hand slips between your fingers before you can close them. His hand is clammy, mushy, and semi-glutinous, while the fingers never exert themselves sufficiently to close. The arm and hand droops, and the mentality, power, and health is in exact accordance with the lifeless member. Their voices are sing-songy and no deeper than the front teeth, and they are prone to sighing, which is a sign, we believe, of a collapsing diaphragm. Their backs are weak, their knees wobble, and they are spending their lives eating pre-digested pickles and non-protein prunes a la Zwieback in order to piece out an absolutely useless existence. If these were outpourings of the mystery schools, occultism would have died ages ago. But thank goodness, these peculiar specimens are not occultists, nor students of anything. They are too weak in most cases to chew their own food, mentally, spiritually, or physically, and are merely collapsing organisms who are using occultism as a refined method of disintegrating. You will find the true disciple of the mystery school outdoing things in every walk of life, whether it is driving stakes, carrying girders, building homes, or cleaning drain pipes. He is at work. He sings at his labors while the weak and lazy sigh at their inertia. His body is strengthened by toil. His hands are blistered with the world's work. And ever in his heart, he is the master mystic. For his hands have built the dreams of his soul into things his brother needs. He has built home to shelter the children of men. He has cleaned the drains that they might be well. His own work is carried on as a menial, but he is the one who has won the game. Many a god has bowed in humble servility to one far less than he, while many a fool has stood on his hind legs to sneer at the divine. So there you have this rather scathing piece by Manly P. Hall referring to folks that he would assume, you have to remember this was written in 1923, really toward the, I don't want to say, it's just after the apex of spiritualism as a religion in the early 20th century. So in 1923, you've got people out there of all walks of life who appear to be kind of like charlatans in that they dive into this mastery of spiritualism. And really, not anything of substance to them. And we see this today in a lot of authors, actually. But I really like this piece. The piece actually ends with, to be continued, but I've been looking so far in the next year and a half, 2 years worth of issues, and he never seems to write a follow-up to this piece. Now, if I find it, great. If I don't, then I would probably consider it, maybe he slept on it and decided not to, or that he said everything he wanted to say. What I do love, though, is that he praises the fact that people work. Your everyday, quote-unquote, occultist, your person who is working toward betterment, the goal of Freemasonry, are people who are at work, people who are doing great things. They're not, you know, lazy people just walking around shirking everything they can shirk in order to get by, or these wonderful examples of some of that goes on in, well, a lot of occult schools, as most people know. You know, I've written about those people in some of the occult profile series on the Midnight Freemasons. It's important to understand that as a seeker of knowledge, if you are somebody who is at work in the world, that's more important than somebody who has been able to rest on the laurels of somebody else's pocketbook and survive. There were, of course, some digs in here. You know, the person who preaches to you and then asks you for money, or all of these kind of things are in here. And I think Paul's opinion of them is clear enough without diving too far in. There were some parts of this where I read it, and I had if you could see my face when I was reading this, there's probably a look of, oh my gosh, that he's going to say this. But I really enjoyed the piece, and I'll put a link to this issue of the magazine in the show notes, and please do visit iapsop.com. The next piece I have comes from the Rosicrucian, a quarterly record of the sovereign transactions with occasional notes on Freemasonry and other kindred subjects. This particular issue is the Rosicrucian number 3, which was published in 1869, January. This is the first 3 series of this journal, contributions by K.R.H. Mackenzie, notably his visits to Eliphas Levi in 1861, Robert Wentworth Little, Dr. Woodman William Carpenter, and the rest. Carpenter's contributions consist of a plea to take spiritualism and its phenomena seriously. Listed in F. Leigh Gardner, A Catalogue Renaissance of Works on the Occult Sciences, Volume 1, Rosicrucian Books, London, privately printed 1903. So that's kind of the information about the publication. And the article is just a one-pager, so I wanted to go ahead and read that. And I found it interesting. It seems to be a reason for the Rosicrucian group within Freemasonry. So let's take it on. The Rosicrucians. This society is calculated to meet the requirements of those worthy Masons who wish to study the science and antiquities of the craft and trace it through its successive developments to the present time, also to cull information from all the records extant of those mysterious societies which had their existence in the dark ages of the world when might mean right, when every man's hand was against his brother, and when such combinations were necessary to protect the weak against the strong. Much interesting and useful information may be collected, and we earnestly invite the fraternity to aid us in our search for truth. In this age of skepticism, the truths of Christianity are not safe from the hands of the spoiler, and under the pseudonym of common sense, our most cherished faith suffers much loss from those who have nothing in common with us but the mere name of Mason. Without possessing one spark of its vivifying influence, one ray of light which is from above, that shineth more and more unto the perfect day, and which, like the genial sunshine, bears life and immortality in its beams. As the natural sun yields life and light to all on whom it shines, so the light of truth purifies and immortalizes all who bask in its rays. Although the true Mason works in silence and retirement, he is not the less an ardent lover of light always searching after truth and with an insatiable thirst for knowledge. Of what use would it be to transmute all other metals to gold, or were the advantage of living here beyond our allotted span, to survive all our kith and kin if, as we believe, this life is but the prelude to a far higher and more glorious existence? It is not, however, to be wondered at that in those dark ages when ignorance, like a pale of darkness, had obscured, as with a thick cloud, all that was good, all that was true, the benighted alchemist thought otherwise and spent his whole life in seeking for that which, when found, would be worse than useless. But the elixir of life and the philosopher's stone are not the mere myths they have been hitherto represented. They are living truths and actual realities possessed of which a true Mason walks unscathed through the dangers and turmoils of this sublunary abode, with his eye, the eye of faith, firmly fixed on the mansions above, where the sun never sets and the skies are without a cloud, where he knows that after this transitory life shall have passed away with all its changing scenes of pleasure and of pain, he has a home, immortal as the heavens, where the great architect of the universe lives and reigns forever, and where sorrow and falsehood have no place, but truth and light and wisdom and unclouded joy shall reign supreme, to attain which let brotherly love, relief, and truth be our unfailing guide. Secretary General. Again, that is from an excerpt from the Rosicrucian, a quarterly record of the Society's transactions from 1869. And now let's go ahead and check out this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison.
Masonic education is all the rage with the crowd I run with. And this is, by the way, a good thing. I seem to hear more about Masonic education now than ever before. Ever before being defined as since I joined the craft 21 years ago. We may not always stop to think that Masonic education is a broad term that can take many forms. It can be a deep, spiritual, esoteric subject that, frankly, sometimes winds up being over my head, or it can be something lightweight, maybe an account of something a brother did, or even a funny anecdote. Usually the subject falls somewhere in between. Doesn't matter. Whatever form it takes, Masonic education is the hot topic du jour. Hallelujah! When we are new to the degrees and are asked what we want, we respond that we want light, and progressively more of it. In other words, our Masonic journey is a search for enlightenment, and the path for that journey is education. Keep it coming. However, I hear a lot of dissent about some of the other things we do. Oh man, not another bean dinner. Or, what's with all the service projects? What are we, the Rotary? No offense meant to the Rotary. A fine organization, but different than the Freemasons. See, I like those things too. The bean dinners, the meals before the meetings, and all the social events give me a chance to get together with my brothers and informally kick things around. Those conversations usually aren't very heavy, but they're enjoyable. The social interaction we have with our brothers is an important part of what our fraternity is. We don't want our organization to be all joking and no substance, but I also wouldn't want to exclude it. All work and no play makes Hiram a dull boy. Also, there are the service projects. In my area, we help with the Child Identification Program, which, in the past decade, has helped return at least 8 missing or abducted children to their homes out of about 250,000 registered. That and other projects give the brothers a sense of fulfillment. You know, it's the old, it's better to give than receive thing. Community service. Let's have more of that, too. So recapping, When we get together as brothers, we're doing a broad range of things. We have social interaction at our events. We help make our communities better places through our service projects. And we seek enlightenment. Freemasonry needs all of these. In fact, couldn't we call our social interaction brotherly love, our community service relief, and our quest for enlightenment a search for truth? Brotherly love, relief, and truth. Where have I heard that before? We are more than Masonic education, and that is outright blasphemy to some. During this scary epidemic, when we sit cooped up in our houses, held hostage by a tiny, unseen enemy, that fact may be more apparent than ever before. We have books, internet, and can have just about as much Masonic education as we want to dig out on our own. Those lodge service projects are more or less on hold. And those social gatherings, apart from a few online meetings for some, are non-existent. What is truth without its close companions, brotherly love, and relief? And now, at least temporarily, those companions are out of reach. We miss them. As the song says, they paved paradise and put up a parking lot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? Stay safe, brothers. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, this next piece comes from Alm, the Universal Brotherhood, published November 1897, volume number 12, number 8. And the title of the article is called The Universal Brotherhood of Man by E.A. Mearsheimer. Let's dig in. This ideal, the Universal Brotherhood of Man. This ideal, when first approached, from an intellectual standpoint, presents no great encouragement for the realization of its truth. Its consideration must be accompanied by the repetitive faculty which lies in the heart, that feeling of natural, unrestrained sympathy which arises out of the inner nature of man when not tainted by selfish motives. Even a superficial investigation, however, leads us to a labyrinth of thought in which there is no logical escape from the conclusion that somehow a unity exists between all human beings. If we once begin to analyze the feelings we experience in our daily contact with our fellow men and take into consideration the natural promptings of the heart, we find ourselves possessed of much brotherly sympathy with the welfare of others. A scene of affliction instantly quickens the tender fellow feeling. See how people rush to the assistance of a falling child, how they shudder at the accident, the unfailing pity deep down with the diseased. Why, who would say the world is so depraved as not to recognize this? Only the rush for personal joys and pleasures causes us to forget it. Let us wait when the new religion of quote-unquote brotherhood shall have taken root, then we will not fail in our duty and forget. The same energy which is now active in competition and strife will be directed instead to mutual happiness, helpfulness. Poor fools who do not yet know that to do the most good is productive of the greatest amount of happiness. No settled belief exists, immutability of natural law, or the unity underlying boundless nature, hence the unphilosophic mind does not concern itself with the possible relation which it bears to all existing things. The unity of all things is no empty phrase. It pervades all departments of nature. Even in the material world, scientific research has led to the conclusion that matter is homogeneous as substance. Elements are found to be compounds. Greater differentiation is discovered step by step, and it is seen that by changing the molecular arrangement, one form of matter is transformable into another. This shows the underlying synthetic union in the invisible essence of matter. The separateness of mankind is analogous to this. Division is apparent but not real. Its union is also contained in one invisible essence, God, or the great self, which is, synthesis of all. In the process of evolution, humanity has differentiated from the great homogeneous ocean of consciousness in order that the soul may gain experience in matter. Being now on the outer circle of manifestation, it appears to be a part, but it is destined in its natural course to return to the prima unity from whence it came. The thread which has spun itself out from unity into differentiation connects each individual with the parent source and through it with all else, and the innate qualities of the soul, love, sympathy, and charity, are the manifestations thereof in man. These reside in the heart. According to the esoteric philosophy, the race has fortunately reached the outermost stage of realization of separateness. The time is at hand for the ascent on the return arc. The pendulum is swinging back and will bring with it an awakening towards spirituality. A psychic wave has already begun to sweep over the globe. In its course, it will rouse the latent spiritual faculties of mankind and develop intuition to a degree that will cause great changes in the social economy and produce a realization of our birthright, the universal brotherhood of man. Neither science nor religion, with their present-day dogmatic methods, will greatly help in the evolution of this new faculty. A more potent and convincing agent has to be called into service to induce a revelation of the truth which is spread upon the wings of time. This agent is the power of direct perception of truth from within, where all knowledge and wisdom reside. Its first fruits will be born from the blossoms of love of mankind. Its second from independence of thought and the courage to rely on one's own intuitions. These will remove the shackles of perceived notions and the veils which have gathered and surrounded ourselves on our journey through matter during many lives. The psychic force active now has touched millions of people. The spiritual fires are burning lit all over the earth, and presently the soul of man will breathe freedom from its fetters, and each man or woman will become conscious of his or her spiritual equality with the best of the living. Every man is a potential God. This is not believed by many, nor is the nobility of their calling known to them or even suspected. Cowed into subjection by custom and conventionality, they think themselves slaves still, who must obey that self-created master or perish. How different would be the conditions of men if they had no fear of their neighbor's opinion? Fear has no place in the religion of brotherhood. Its doctrine is founded on supreme universal justice, where every man works out his own destiny and gets his deserts according as he himself has earned them. In this, there is nothing and no one to fear, certainly not our fellow traveler, who is one with ourselves and bent upon the homeward journey towards union with the All. The divine nature of man is obscured at the present stage of evolution by his material rind, and though it may be difficult to comprehend why the divine self should have surrounded itself with such an apparently inappropriate vehicles of expression as we meet with sometimes in human garb, yet the knowledge of the spiritual thread which binds us to all should enable us to regard the outward appearance as only part of what the soul really is. It will be admitted that our own standard of judgment is only our own state of enlightenment. As we are, so do we see others. We have no faculty at present with which to see and judge the real man. The soul, we may sense it when our intentions are active, but were we to see the real man and know him with all his past and realize our own spiritual inseparability from him, our opinion would be changed regarding him. To have even a slight grasp of the subject of spiritual unity of all mankind induces broader views and a more philosophic attitude towards social and individual problems. It opens up the latent but natural resources of the heart consciousness, from which flows universal compassion, the most potent of beneficent forces harmonizing within and without. It not only promotes a wider sweep of moral influence, but also furnishes the key to conduct and duty. It leads to a knowledge of universal laws and problems and to wisdom, for within the heart is the corresponding center of all life and light. All right, now this piece from the Universal Brotherhood magazine is really interesting. It's a fraternal magazine, but also it's kind of blended with the modern views that we're permeating. through all things. And this is, of course, this idea of spiritualism. But spiritualism went through some weird times. There were a lot of what I would call charlatans and people, you know, just swindling folks out of money and talking to the dead and things. And that's what a lot of people think about when they think about spiritualism. But true spiritualism really evolved into the New Age concept. And this New Age concept, the Piscean Age, as many have called it, is really just this kind of idea that one day there's going to be this era where truly each of us, inherent to our being, as in not something we need to work at, just automatically cares for everybody else. And this, as much as we want to say we do, we all work for this, if we do it at all, right? Like this requires our conscious work to be able to care for certain people. Because it's not like you just automatically call somebody because you want to check in on them, right? There are people that you probably don't want to call, that you do call to check in on them, right? You don't want to spend 20 minutes on the phone when you only have 5, so you naturally put off calling that person, that kind of thing. And that's just a small example of caring on the level of something that's understandable or relatable today in terms of how things would be looked at in the quote-unquote Piscean Age, the age of Aquarius, as they would call it. They talk about the arc, right, like moving into this age, and we really kind of are moving into that age because, I don't know about you guys, but I've witnessed kids growing up, and kindness is the new cool. There's a lot of bullying that's gone the way of the dodo, which is great. However, it's been replaced with this kindness, this acceptance, this standing with your neighbor, standing with your brother, standing with your fellow students, your peers. And this is wonderful. And we're moving this way. And what I also love about this piece is that it talks about understanding the divine self as somebody who works, somebody who toils, somebody who is giving back, somebody who is truly working on these things. Just incredible concepts. But specifically for today, I think this really speaks to our existence right now. It's kind of interesting that these pieces line up with today and how we're having to live. And I really appreciate the viewpoint that these pieces convey. And that is a high degree of praise for each and every person out there who is not only studying the texts and trying to learn them and live them, but also goes to work, stocking shelves at midnight, listening to podcasts overnight, driving trucks across the nation, having to go into the office to send, you know, a bazillion emails, you know, whatever the case is. This is awesome. But that's also it for this week. So thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy this program and you want to consider helping, go to wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out our options there. My thanks, as usual, goes out to our fellows, our contributors, and our producers. Many thanks to all of you who assist this program in bringing it to not only other Masons, but to anybody interested in the royal art. I'll have links to most of the things that we talked about this week, including the IAPSOP.com, which is the archive where I pull a lot of my material from, out of copyright things, you know, publications that were not for sale because they just wanted to get the message out, things like Manly T. Hall's work. Just really want to say thank you so much. I hope you stay safe. I hope you stay healthy. And if you want to pen pal or something, you can find my address on the website. That's it, guys. So thanks so much for listening to this program. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.